Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM. Talkspace.com/boom. B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. Going to do something a little bit similar, a little bit different today, and the similar part is that it's a mailbag, but the different part is that I'm calling it an email bag because this is not something where I put something out on Twitter or on Facebook or on Reddit and said, hey, answer questions. It's me going through some of the stuff that I've gotten personally in the process of putting the show together and doing it, and that's a wonderful thing because those questions aren't really prompted. It's more just things that people were wondering about. So they're all Warriors-related, though some of them are less Warriors-related than others, and so that will be the first part of the show, and then depending really on how long it goes and where I feel it is, I don't want to really do too much in terms of what I'm looking forward to for this season, because this is the last episode I'm going to do as a solo thing before the start of the season, but I will talk about some basic predictions and things like that, because those are the elements of this that are, you know, you could say functionally invalidated by the season starting, because it's not fair to make predictions, preseason predictions, post start of the season. So I'll do a little bit in terms of that towards the end. Also, this episode is brought to you by Athletes Collective. It is a great high-end athletic apparel company. You can go to athletescollective.com, use the promo code Warriors, and get 15% off your first order. Highly recommend it. I love their stuff myself. So these questions are longer, and something I'm going to do also partially because I didn't get explicit permission to read it verbatim is that I am going to summarize these questions, whereas with the Reddit mailbag and things like that, also because they're available publicly in that sense, where I will pretty much just read them verbatim. But this one, I like these ones, also some of them are really long. I will summarize it. So the first one is from Grady Bolter, and the kind of the gist of the question is the idea of the shift in the NBA inspired by the Warriors towards players who are more versatile. And the example he uses is the difference between peak Tony Allen and somebody like Chris Middleton. So Chris Middleton is not the defender that Tony Allen, especially peak Tony Allen, was, but because he can do more on the floor, he can, you know, you can use him differently and the teams value that. And there is a lot of truth to that because there are a lot of different ways to think about the league, but one of the biggest changes of the last, let's say about 5 years, you could say 10 if you really wanted to, but I've focused more on the last five, is the ability for a coaching staff and players to more ruthlessly attack a specific and glaring weakness. So the example I use and fall back on year by year with this is the way the Warriors defended Tony Allen in the 2015 playoffs. So Tony Allen is a spectacular player, a great individual defender, but he has this problem offensively that he not only is a bad shooter, but is largely an unwilling shooter. And Kevin Pelton has talked about this before, and it is important to note that those two things can be separated to a point, because if a guy is a bad shooter, then you think about it a different way. But if he's also unwilling to shoot, then you get into an issue of how do I need to defend them and do I really need to put somebody on them close? And then that forces the help defense. So when the Warriors put Bogut on him, the calculus was that they wouldn't have to go after it in the same way, and that Bogut could be used then as a help defender and essentially play 4-on-5 and leave that guy out there. And by and large, it worked. And so there is a truth to the idea that players with a very glaring negative can be exploited. However, it must be noted that that's not always true. For example, people who listen to Dunked On know that I railed time and again during the Spurs-Thunder series that San Antonio was not making Enes Kanter defend in space. That was the thing he was bad at, and they weren't really doing that. They were having his guy post him up more often and everything like that. And so you have to get into situations where you capitalize on that inefficiency, and in some ways that's why being a bad shooter is the easiest one to exploit, is that it's not hard to identify, and if you can do it as ruthlessly as the Warriors did, you can attack it by just not having a guy there. So there are other ones that are more nuanced and everything like that, but a non-shooter who doesn't have the ball in their hands is there. And the ball in their hands part of this is important because one way you can, for certain players with certain skill sets, you can combat this idea is by putting the ball in their hands. And Giannis, for the Bucks, is the best modern example of this, where his value skyrocketed, one, because he's good with the ball in his hands, and two, because he was a lot less effective without it, because he's not a great shooter, he's not super confident, and he can cut, but you don't have a lot of surplus value offensively if you are a non-shooter or a limited shooter at a position other than center. And so one way to kind of counter that, and this is also what the Celtics did with Evan Turner, is you want to put the ball in their hands. And so that way you have to defend a guy who has the ball. I mean, that's just the nature of the business. And so that was one of the counters also to, theoretically, that the Grizzlies could have done against the Warriors when they did that with Tony Allen. But you need somebody who is capable in those situations and will do the right thing. I mean, people who listen to my stuff know my general phrase is two dribbles and a good decision. And that's usually used for closeouts, but it's also true here. So if you have a guy who can't do that, so if they can't hit that threshold, they're going to have really strong positives. And by and large, that will be because they do something that is of superior value and they can do it at a level that you can't get someone else. And so two prominent examples of that would be Ricky Rubio, because his passing and his defense are so good. Ricky Rubio is an underrated defender. And so that piece together, that he can run an offense, even though he doesn't really shoot, and he's such a great passer and he's such a great defender. So you can build a really good player. You can build somebody who's a positive impact for his team. And we will have to see, because we haven't yet, whether that starts to rear its head in the playoffs, because at that point, teams can game plan more specifically for what somebody does or does not do. So that will be a lingering question for Minnesota or whoever has Rubio, in case they are silly enough to trade him unless they get a real crazy offer, because he's very good. Another one you could probably use, depending on how you want to do it, is somebody like Ben Wallace or Rudy Gobert. Gobert is getting more offensively capable, but if you are a center and your job is to be the defensive anchor and you can do that at an elite level, then you can tolerate very limited offensive games. And Bismack Biyombo on the Raptors in the playoffs did a nice job of this, even kind of getting more into the modern concept of it. And you can do it at various spots in terms of like what they bring and what they take away. But those are the two most obvious, is somebody who can run an offense and someone who can defend at the center position. Another one is James Harden. Harden is an elite offensive player, great shot creator, amazing drawing fouls, can create for himself and others, and generally speaking, he's a bad defender. But the creation of offense, especially at his level, you deal with that. But this all ties in with an idea, I think I wrote about it for Real GM like 3 or 4 years ago, but the concept is of, the term I like to use is reciprocal versatility. So the idea of reciprocal versatility is that one of the biggest benefits you get for a player who is versatile is that they can slide around. So a great example of this, and I think it might be the one I used in the piece, was when Ron Artest was at his best defensively, he could guard 1 through 4 or 1 through 5. Prime LeBron was pretty similar. That's a great thing. Unambiguously, unquestionably, it's a great thing. But it's a lot less valuable if the other players on the team can't slide around a little bit too, because then you're getting this benefit and you're just kind of, you can't use it in the same way. And Klay Thompson's ability to guard point guards is another good example of this. Klay does a good job on ones. He uses his size advantage. There are certain guys he struggles with, but he can do that. If Curry couldn't credibly, if temporarily or whatever, guard another team's 2 or 3 in certain circumstances, that value by Klay wouldn't really matter. So you have to make sure that you have that in other players. And that's something you generally want if you can get it. You know, it's one of those, it's a benefit, but it is not, you know, it's not the most important thing in the world, but it's something that's nice. And that's also a question with James Harden and the Rockets, because they're going to ask him to defend different positions, go into different roles. And so you make that sort of sacrifice to get the right defensive players, to get the right structure around a guy like Harden. But you do have to make those choices, and that's why it gets more complicated when you get into somebody like, I don't want to pick on him, but like, you know, let's say like Doug McDermott. McDermott is a very talented shooter, but when he started in the league, he was horrendous defensively. And so it's like, he has to be good enough on the first unit in particular, good enough offensively to justify that or get better defensively. JJ Redick is a great, is an amazing example of a guy partially burnishing his value by getting better at his weakness as opposed to improving his strength. And Redick got a lot better defensively. He also got better offensively, and that made him a starter. That made him somebody who was a quality starter and an important piece on some successful teams. So franchises can do a lot of these different things at the same time, but the idea of versatility is also something else that's very important, which is how much can you add to the table while taking a little bit away? Draymond Green adds a lot, depending on even where you want to start. Like, his defense is incredible. His playmaking, when he has his jump shot, his jump shooting. And he takes very little away because he makes good decisions. He is a good rebounder. And so those players are incredibly valuable in the league because that allows you to do a lot of different things. The small lineups hinge on Draymond's ability. We'll see how much they miss Harrison Barnes being able to defend fours, but that sort of thing is incredibly important as well, is the idea of what can you do outside of your lane? And that will be a major defining point as we move forward. Karl Anthony Towns, if he can do big man stuff and other stuff, is a great example because he can, you know, he had a nice step back three. I don't know if any of you guys saw the video. I retweeted it on, I think that was Friday, which is incredible. And the other reason I want to bring up Towns is because Towns is an excellent test study for another concept. And the Wolves might show this, but they also have enough flaws that they might not, which is the idea of how a perimeter capable center allows teams to use some of these otherwise limited players. And the Warriors will, at moments, you know, they kind of, this is part of the idea of using Draymond at center, is, you know, playing five out is great. And that gives you a lot of options, gives you a lot of creativity offensively. And we will see a lot of that this year with the Warriors and, you know, maybe some other teams. I think they'll fiddle around with some small lineups too. The other thing that having a, I don't necessarily want to use the word stretch five because that implies more of like a shooter type, but somebody who can do some of that, is that it also opens up the floor for players at other positions who are good at posting up. And the Warriors have some great guys here, Sean Livingston, Kevin Durant, both talented post-up players, especially when they have a size advantage, which they often do because they're big for their positions. So playing with a five out, whether that be you're playing five out nominally or whether that mean you're doing kind of like a different 4-1, can really help because you add value to those guys because they can post up and you, and they don't, it's harder to help because if it's easy when you help because let's say you're playing them with a center that can't shoot, then the guy's right there. He doesn't, you know, he can help off with impunity, or if the center's just physically in the area, you can do that. And teams have gotten better about, you know, when this Miami was dealing with that with Birdman, who was limited as a shooter, they would have him in this kind of spot where the center would be able to help, but then he could crash in for dunk. And, you know, there's a part of that that you're going to have to take in with it. But playing centers who can really shoot moves that guy further out, and so it's harder to help. And so Minnesota, why I brought them up is that not only can the Warriors do this, but Minnesota can, because Minnesota, partially because Flip Saunders was so into the idea of various guys posting up, the Warriors did this too under Mark Jackson, is that they have some guys in Wiggins and Shabazz Muhammad who are very talented posting up. And so it's a lot easier to make that work when you have versatility of the five. So this does kind of go along with the idea that was the original question Grady posed, which is versatility and unusual skill sets anywhere can help you in ways that you can't even necessarily imagine or quantify. However, that versatility cannot come at the expense of a lack of skill or a lack of flexibility. And so, let's say Myers Leonard, or back in the day, Mehmet Okur, you know, you need to make sure, especially when you're dealing with starters, that those players are good enough at everything else because they can give you a tactical advantage, but the downsides can be serious. And so the very special players, the best of the best, are the ones that give you the tactical benefit without forcing the hard choice. You know, Steph Curry shooting, Draymond Green at the five, Karl Anthony Towns maybe, you know, like those type of guys are prime LeBron or prime Michael Jordan, where they can be elite offensive players and elite defensive players. And that's why the best are the best. So really, you're dealing in that realm with something different, and that's why those players are so great. Maybe Anthony Davis gets there too. But outside of them, you're looking for that kind of versatility. And there's one other point I wanted to make on this question, which is I'm legitimately unsure and very interested to see if the league moves, especially on second units, away from those rim-protecting centers that I like so much, towards guys who are more capable switchers. Because switching gives you some outs defensively if you can do it and hold on, just because you create less daylight. And we probably see some teams do that a little bit this year. I wish Sacramento was really going to try some switch-heavy stuff with Cauley-Stein at the five, because he's one of the rare fives that can actually do that. The Sixers might with Joel Embiid, but those will be big questions, because if that can work, then you're looking for something a little bit different. And this ties in before with the idea of, if you can get somebody who can do that and not make the same sacrifices, if you can get a guy like Draymond who can protect the rim when necessary, can switch out when necessary, that's great. But most teams are going to have to kind of choose one lane or the other, one archetype or the other. And so if both of those work, if we can get to a switch-heavy system where they can really function and prevent the seams that generate the offense in the first place, then that will be a fundamental change for the way that the league works and everything like that. So I'm excited to see it, because this year there are so many more coaches that seem amenable to trying this out. And so we'll really see how it works. And I'm excited because there are a lot of ideas in basketball, and the Warriors will be a good example of this. If you listen to the podcast I did with Eric Gunderson, I think we talked about this a little bit, about the Warriors will be a great test for certain ideas that we've had in terms of offense about, like, oh, will this work? And some of the other stuff, more kind of base fundamental tests we've never gotten to see, now that there are more experimental coaches, now that there are more personnel, like now there are more centers that can switch and, you know, do all that sort of stuff, we'll see if some of those ideas can actually work. And so we've been floating them around for a few years, and now we'll actually get to see if they work in practice. Next question is a lot shorter, for those of you who thought that was a long answer. It's from Alejandro Munoz, and it's, if they're fully healthy, what are the chances the Warriors go 16-0 in the playoffs, and basically how would that rank in terms of accomplishments? It is exceedingly unlikely that the Warriors go 16-0, and that's why it would be so impressive. Because even if you are an overwhelming favorite, you still have to have everything go right 16 times. And there will be cold shooting nights, there will be bad defensive nights, there will be, you know, technical fouls, suspensions, you know, all that sort of thing. And so it's incredible if they can pull it off. It would be one of the most impressive accomplishments, unless there was some sort of massive mitigating factor, like, you know, every team's star player got hurt in game one or something crazy like that. But it gets into the idea that I always think is so interesting, which is the difference, I've made this analogy before, maybe not on a podcast, between the difference between golf and tennis. So in tennis, when you're in a tournament, you have to beat the person in front of you, and you have to do it every single time. And that's true, you know, that is impressive. You know, let's say for a big tournament, it could be a bunch of different rounds. But in golf, to win a tournament, by and large, you have to beat everyone. So if somebody has an anomalous night or a tournament, if someone, you know, shoots a 65 or even better than that, you're going to have to beat them too. And while you would think that the NBA playoffs would be more like the tennis example, because it is a tournament and you face who's in front of you, when you start to get into winning every single game, you transition from that into the anomaly land, because you just have so many different bites at the apple. So it's more like there are a lot of golfers on the course and you have to beat all of them every time. So regardless of what happens. So it would be incredibly impressive. I think their chances are low, even though I think they're going to be one of the best teams, if they can be fully healthy going into the playoffs, one of the best teams we've ever seen. Certainly less than 5%, probably more around 1%. And as of right now, their chances of doing it are probably higher than we've seen in modern times, but that's still incredibly low because the league is full of great teams, the league is full of great coaches, and the Warriors are good, and they're really good, but 16-0 is an incredible accomplishment, especially considering it has been so long since expansion and because it's the playoffs, so you're not playing like garbage teams. Everybody's going to be capable. And so, yeah, it would be an incredible accomplishment. I have said before that I think that it's a very real chance that the Warriors lose five or fewer games in the playoffs, but going from 5-0 is a massive, massive, massive difference. So we'll see how it turns out. I've been wrong before, but I really, really don't expect it. Take a quick moment to talk about Athletes Collective. I really do like endorsing, I can call it that, supporting products that I believe in and that I really like. And Athletes Collective is an amazing example of that because it is some, I've been trying it out. I've had some of their stuff for a few months now, and the quality is great. It is comfortable. It is supportive. It does exactly what you need it to do. And the difference between it and some of the other high brands, and I'm not taking anything away from them, I love those brands too, is that because it doesn't have logos on it, you can get it for a lower price. And when you can get it at a lower price and you don't have the downside in terms of, you know, cut rate quality or anything like that, you get a really good product. And so you can get it for 40 to 50% off the price of some of the other major brands. And I've really appreciated over time how versatile their stuff is and, you know, how you can use it for working out. And I certainly do that, but you can also use it as an undershirt for various different settings. Or you can, you know, you can have it as just something if you're somebody when you're around the house. It's comfortable. It looks good. You can make it work in that context as well. So if you want to, instead of just hearing me talk about it, you want to try it for yourself, you can go to athletescollective.com and you can use the promo code Warriors and you get 15% off your first order. And considering I already mentioned the stuff is 45 to 50% off the price of, you know, call it comparable stuff from bigger brands, 45 to 50% off is great. Getting another 15% off is even better. So athletescollective.com, use the promo code Warriors and check it out. The next question is from Michael Muldoon. And again, it's going to be one that I summarized because it's pretty long. And what he was getting at is the idea between the difference between Zaza Pachulia and Andrew Bogut and that they do different things. But his thesis, if you want to call it that, was whether Zaza could replicate Bogut's impact on the offensive end. And certainly the hope would be that he can do that because Pachulia, David West are nowhere near Bogut's equal defensively. And so you're looking for somebody who can do it in that offensive role. And there certainly is some truth to that. Wrote a piece, did some research for The Athletic back, I think it was in August, about their offensive roles. And one of the most interesting parts of Pachulia's statistical background is that his last year in Atlanta, he really kicked up his assist percentage. So basically assist rate. So the proportion of possessions that you have that ends in an assist for you. And that happens, you know, guys, whether it be that their role changes or something else like that, that can happen for a year. And so you kind of sit there and go, oh, okay, we'll see where it goes. The next year he played in Milwaukee. It didn't stay as high as it was. I think it was at like 13% his last year in Atlanta, but I believe it stayed in double digits. And then last year in Dallas, it dropped to like high single digits. I think it was like 9.8%, but it was still higher than the rest of his career. And that was really interesting because it's three different teams, three different systems, three different coaches, and it stayed higher than it had been before. So it just seems like there's a part of his game that was unlocked in that way. So they certainly can use Bogut in that role. I mean, they can use Zaza in the Bogut role by and large. And the other big difference, and this ties in with another part that he talked about, which is the fundamental difference between having Kevin Durant on this team and not, is that defensive attention is very different. So part of the reason you wanted the ball in Bogut's hands is that teams had to pay attention to him when he's like that. And he's also a really good screener, so you can use the ball in his hands as a vessel for handoffs and various things like that. Pachulia can do that. That is a part of his game. But something else that's very useful for him is that if the defense lapses, he can get the ball and do something positive with it, whether that be passing it again or finishing. And the ability to do that without worrying about being fouled, because he's about a 73% free throw shooter, is a huge benefit for this. And while Pachulia has benefited greatly, the guy who I've seen it affect them the most is David West, because West is used to having fours on him. He usually, in his career, his illustrious career, he's played mostly power forward. Having centers on him is another huge benefit, because he can handle that, and you know, they're generally less mobile and less willing to come out. But it goes beyond that, because he's also getting guys that just aren't paying as much attention, and that can be as big a benefit as just having somebody who's less capable on you. And so they're going to use David West in those kinds of circumstances, and he will do very, very well, because he will get larger spaces, larger seams, because guys just aren't paying attention. They're helping out on somebody else. They're helping out, let's say it's a Curry Green pick and roll, but they don't want to help off Durant. They don't want to help off Clay. So then it's probably going to be David West or Pachulia's guy that does that. And West is going to get more open looks than he's probably had in the rest of his career per minute. I mean, he's going to play fewer minutes, but he will benefit a lot from that. And one of the other things Michael asked in his question was about whether Durant can operate in that role that Bogut had as well. Sure, he can. There are a lot of other things that he can do well. And this also ties in with the first question in terms of using a non-traditional position for, let's say, post-ups when you have a center that can shoot. And so the Warriors can do that with the Draymond at center lineups, and then they can allow Durant and Livingston to operate in, it's a modified role from what Bogut did, but they can do that, and that's something that's certainly possible and could be very effective, especially in Durant's case, because he's just bigger than almost all the dudes that'll be on him, and because the Warriors have so much talent offensively that they can scheme in switches. And it gets into a small idea that I'm going to talk about more later on, in maybe this week, maybe later in the season, about how zealously the Warriors start possessions early in the shot clock to try to force switches. Because the challenge with attacking a switch is that sometimes it takes a little bit of time. I mean, you want to do it really fast, because then it gives the opponents less time to recover. But first of all, you might need more than one chance to get the switch. The example that's great here is the Cavs trying to get Festus Ezeli onto LeBron in Game 7. One time, the last time, it took them three shots at it to do it. And so starting earlier in the shot clock is a great way to make that happen. So we will see that more often, but how the Warriors attack in those moments, so really that's more off of a make. You know, are they going to get into stuff earlier? Are they going to kind of float around for a few seconds? And, you know, you don't want guys to burn themselves out by being gunning for it every second of every game, but using, you know, let's say that first 4 seconds after you cross the timeline to get into something can be a big help. And the teams that initiate late sometimes get burned because they just don't have enough time either to get into what they were intending to run, but also so enough time to attack the mismatch once they get it. And so sometimes you see a team get what they wanted, but they, let's say they have it with 3 seconds left and they can't do a whole heck of a lot. And so that can be a real challenge for teams, and it's something to, you know, to keep an eye on with how they initiate in the offense, and also how that changes based on personnel. Because, like, let's say the Thunder, you know, there were moments where they would attack early, and then especially late in the games. I'm going to at some point rewatch Game 6 of the Conference Finals, but in that game in particular, it felt like they were initiating really late, and that hurts against a talented half-court defense like the Warriors had last year, and I'm sure all fans hope they have this year. So I think that's enough on that question. And the last one that I'm going to hit, but there are a couple different aspects of it, is from Ron Ackner. And the core idea is, how do you evaluate a team's training staff and player fragility? And it's a great question. And part of the reason it's a great question is that there isn't a clear answer. And so it gets into something that Nate and I, when we do Dunked On, I think our legal training really does help us with, which is the idea that there can be either multiple contributing causes, or that you can't be necessarily be sure with a small sample what the source is. And so the guy that I think of for this in the early days was somebody like Bradley Beal. So Bradley Beal gets hurt a lot. You don't know if that's the Wizards medical staff, if that's just Bradley Beal or not. But then when you start to see other players deal with issues and get to nagging, like there's some stuff with John Wall and Marcin Gortat had some stuff, then you start to look at, okay, maybe it's the medical staff. And you also want to look at kind of more basic mistakes. And one of the obvious ones here is Quincy Pondexter on the New Orleans Pelicans, where he was playing on a knee injury. And sometimes that's the player's fault because the player wants to be tough and, you know, do all that. Sometimes it's the medical staff's fault where they say, oh, you know, you can push it and be okay. But broadly speaking, if a medical staff, if they're involved and they're pushing a guy, particularly when it's unnecessary, like let's say it's the middle of the season or something like that, then that often falls with them. And if it's a single player, if he doesn't tell the team, then, you know, if it's not something that can be easily perceived, then, you know, that's kind of on him. And you do run into these challenges of not really knowing what the causation of something is. And that's why the most important thing as somebody who is a fan or an analyst in these kinds of situations is to be ready to process new information and adjust your opinions, adjust your findings, adjust your statements based on that. That doesn't mean being wishy-washy. That means understanding that there will be new information that, you know, if you want to use the analogy, the situation can change on the ground. And that isn't just an essential part of analysis, is understanding that you don't know everything and that circumstances can illuminate things and also make them change the way that you think about previously existing stuff. You know, like I think New Orleans medical staff has struggled a lot in recent years. And you know, that has made me think about Anthony Davis a little bit differently. So there is a possibility that Anthony Davis is just injury prone, you know, kind of like the rep that Steph Curry had at a period of time with his ankles. Though I've talked a little bit about the idea that, so Davis's age 23 season, which is the analog to what Curry had the year that he got pulled a lot when the Warriors were tanking, that's the same year. So this is age 23. That was age 23 for Steph. So Curry has been remarkably healthy after that. But one fundamental difference between those two guys is that Curry's stuff was all with one spot and Davis's has been all over his body. And so that, I generally speaking, as unless you think that there's something structurally wrong with that, you know, with the body part like Curry's ankles, generally speaking, I prefer that just because then it can be corrected. But if a guy's just hurt all the time, that's harder to fix. You know, it's just maybe you just have to price in that he's going to miss 10 to 15 games. So that is all there. And then the other part of it, and Ron actually addressed this in kind of in his email, but it is a very interesting part of this whole thing, which is how a player's body affects this. And the example he used, which is a great one, is Ben Simmons. So it was reported that Ben Simmons gained 30 pounds between, like, I think it was when went around draft time and now, and presumably the idea of that was to add mass to play power forward. And it is completely correct from what I understand that adding that kind of mass, especially that quickly, can challenge your joints, can challenge a lot of stuff. And for people who have dealt with that, you know, in their own lives, you know, it can be a real challenge that you're dealing with that. And they're stressing their bodies in a way that is very different and much more intense than what most of us do. But I'm sure a lot of people have dealt with that and just how it changes. I mean, my own body, you know, like there are times that I've gained a little bit of weight and it did feel like my knees and ankles were getting pushed a little bit harder. And when you do it quickly, then that's even tougher because then you don't have as much time to adjust, especially if you're doing kind of like the same athletic regimen and you need to spend a little bit of time to strengthen that stuff. And so it is hard to know whether that's, again, whether that's a medical staff issue or it's a Simmons issue, but it's something to keep in mind. And it is surprising that he did it that quickly as opposed to being a little bit more gradual. But, you know, we will have to take it a little bit by ear and just see how it works out. And it is also important to remember that these impressions can change quickly and that, you know, you have to consider the basis for it. So with Curry, in a way, it was his medical issues were overanalyzed and overstressed because he was sat out as a precautionary measure when the team was trying to tank. But when you look at how many games he missed in the 2011-2012 season, you say, oh my God, look, Curry, he played 26 games that year. But that was because the Warriors didn't want him on the floor because they were trying to keep their pick. And they ended up retaining it because they want a coin flip. I was actually looking at this today because there was somebody asked me about the idea of changing pick protection, and an underrated part of that story is that that was a renegotiated pick protection. The Warriors and the Nets agreed to that top seven after the fact, which is very rare to do, and I believe the Nets got a second rounder as compensation for that. There was a complicated reason for it. But, you know, that sort of thing can happen, and so those kinds of precautionary things are very different from a guy and his team wanting him to be on the floor and he can't due to that injury. So that's something else to always remember, is the context with which it happened. And as you get further away in time, it can get harder to remember why something unusual like that happened. But you need to do your best to do so, because that context is vital in terms of what is precedent and what is not. So you always have to keep an open mind and everything like that. And something else to look for is changes in circumstance. So a player who has been healthy-ish goes to a new team, starts dealing with more issues, or a player who has been on a team that's been tough goes somewhere else and all of a sudden they get better. And so Phoenix's training staff is widely renowned for this exact reason, because guys that have had injury issues have gone there and done better, and then at moments, guys in their situation have gone to other places and struggled. I don't think this is totally fair with Steve Nash, but Nash certainly helped that reputation just because he went to LA and fell apart. But that does happen when you hit your late 30s. So you have to watch all of it and be ready for new information. But it is something that is a very notable part of this process, because it's uncapped. You know, you can spend a lot on that. And because teams that do a good job really do get a benefit. And it's not only the medical staff, it's also the coaching staff's approach to rest and the player's willingness to embrace it, because all of those things fit in. And so Thibodeau got a lot of blame with the Bulls. He certainly did push his players really hard. And then, you know, the players, at a certain point, maybe you need to give them a little bit of push to say, okay, I need to take off a little bit or do something like that. And it's always hard, because especially in sports, it's such a, you know, machismo and an alpha male type thing. But we've seen it now in free agency, but I think we're going to start seeing it more in other contexts, about players being more aware of their own limitations, being aware of their own future. And so if they're putting themselves in harm's way for a situation that doesn't warrant it, I think we'll start to see a little bit more in terms of that. And you do run into situations just with personal chemistry where that can be a real problem, but it's something to watch. So with what happened, it's weird to bring this up as an example, but it's totally true that what LeBron did last year could be a model for players moving forward, which is that he took parts of the regular season off. I mean, he literally took time where he didn't play, but then he didn't hit that last gear until the second round of the play, or third round of the playoffs. And that makes a lot of sense when you've played as many playoff games as he has, when you have as many miles on the tires as he does, even at his relatively young age. And that can be a lesson, that if your team is good enough to survive those dips in the regular season, then why not? You know, why not preserve yourself a little bit? And so whether Durant and Curry and Green take a real lesson from that, even though they're younger, even though they're more late 20s than early 30s, if you can decrease your wear and tear at a time that it can help you, then that's a great thing. And players are also getting a little bit less tied to their counting stats, and that can help in that way too, because you can use things like per 100 possessions or per 36 minutes or whatever you want to do to extrapolate if a guy plays fewer minutes. So we'll see how that works moving forward. And that also ties in with kind of moving into the more prediction-y realm, because people have talked about the idea of the Warriors not having an MVP, even if they're the best team in the league, because they're going to take votes from each other. And that's certainly true. You know, there is a very real possibility of that, where when there's ambiguity about what a team's best player is, it's a lot harder for somebody to win the MVP, because that's the idea of most valuable. And so say, oh, well, they would have gotten there without them. Especially true for Durant this year, just on an unfair subjective realm, because the Warriors won 73 games last year. And if they're not going to do that again this year, then you say, oh, look at that, they won more without him. So that will run against him. And with Curry, you know, it's a little bit more complicated because he was on the team before. So Well, I think that there is a very good logic to the idea with that. The other part that is being underappreciated is that if the Warriors are prioritizing the playoffs as much as it sounds like, and they're as dominant in the regular season as it sounds like, those guys are going to put up lower stats both in terms of totals and in terms of per game. And there are still a lot of, you can call them old school media types, who vote for the MVP who care about that. And so if Curry is averaging fewer points per game because he's playing fewer minutes because they're killing teams, that can't hurt him. There were people who tried to argue, you know, who were trying to use that argument against him in terms of James Harden, and then people realized that was a stupid argument because the reason he was playing fewer minutes is because they were so good. So we'll see if that narrative has changed a little bit over the years. But something else to remember, and this is getting lost a shockingly large amount with some of the conversations that I personally don't care at all about player rankings in that way, you know, like, oh, I think this guy's the best player in the league or anything like that, is the idea, the difference between ceiling and value. So LeBron James, at his best, in my opinion, is the best player in the league. However, we will probably only see that LeBron James at maximum for about 10 games this season. And those games will not occur in the regular season at all. So that should not factor into the MVP if he doesn't show it during the regular season, or let's say he only shows it 5 times, because it's not best player, it's not most outstanding player, it's most valuable player. And if you are not providing that value during the regular season, and it's a regular season award, you should not get credit for it. And it's also an idea in terms of best. You know, if a guy can only summon that power for 5 to 10 games per season, it's a different thing than somebody who does it for 70 or so. And that really does help Steph Curry, because so much of what he does, you don't really tone down or tone up. It's just who he is. And we saw in the Portland game that the special player who just has swagger and who can create something out of nothing and take advantage of mismatches and switches, that guy's still there. And the inconsistency of opportunity, because of how many other stars there are on the team and his fundamental unselfishness, will run against it. But there's a very real chance Steph Curry wins the MVP, just like there's a chance with Durant, just because he's such an incandescent offensive talent. But Curry's, even if last year is an aberration, he won the unanimous MVP, had an incredible season, it's a wide-ranging crop of guys this year, but I haven't seen much to dissuade me from the idea that if he put up a season similar to 2014-15, he wouldn't be the favorite for the MVP. And the only reason would be politics and everything like that. And it's also hard to hold that against Curry, because he's just there. He's just on the team. So that those narratives probably hurt Durant more than Steph. And where I'm going with this is the idea that I think Curry is going to be the deserving MVP if he stays healthy. I am less certain that he is going to win it, because that is a different thing. I'm more comfortable in my own analysis of the basketball than my analysis of the people who vote about the people who play basketball. So that's kind of what I'm thinking with MVP right now. We're going to do a dunked on about this, but one other sneak peek that I'll mention in this for people who listen to this before that, because we haven't recorded it yet, is I think Chris Paul's MVP chances are being underappreciated, because he's an awesome player. There is the possibility of kind of the Kobe lifetime achievement with him, where Kobe probably should have gotten an MVP a few years before and didn't. And so he's right on the cusp, has a great year, team does really well, and so they just give it to him. And the funny part of that is the MVP that Kobe got that year is arguably the one that Chris Paul should have gotten. I mean, Chris Paul, LeBron, there are a few other guys that were great that season. So if the Clippers have the second best record in the West, Chris Paul has another all-star unquestioned season, you know, first team All-NBA, it's easier to give him the award than somebody like Russ or Harden. Let's say they finish no better than fifth. You know, it's hard to give it to those guys. And if LeBron just doesn't really care about the regular season, because why the hell should he, then you get into that kind of a circumstance. And so it's going to be fun. This is a really wide open group, and I think that Curry will deserve it. I think he's going to be the best regular season player in the league again this year. And voter fatigue is also a very real thing, but, you know, there's not much that can be said about that. The other ones I want to talk about, well, Coach of the Year, Kerr's not going to win it unless they win 74. That's just the way that it works. Usually, the way that a coach wins Coach of the Year is that the team really outperforms expectations. And the Warriors can't do that anymore. I mean, unless they go like 82-0 or something, they're not going to outperform regular season expectations. And they don't really care to. And it's not like the point differential story, which might end up being something the Warriors do at a really high level, is going to be enough to move voters. Because somebody, whether it be Minnesota, just because they're way better than they were last year, or the next Portland, Terry Stotts finished second last year, the next team that really just blows away their projections because either a coach does a good job or their team is just good. Those are usually who wins Coach of the Year. The other one is Sixth Man of the Year. And part of me, almost all of me, believes that Iguodala deserved it last year, and the fact that he didn't get it and an undeserving Jamal Crawford did is proof that Iguodala is just not going to win Sixth Man of the Year, because if you don't get it when you have a good case and the winner has a bad case, then you really say that. But the Warriors could, the reporting that they're going to play a little bit more of the small ball lineup, 10 to 12 minutes a game, does lend itself to the idea that maybe people just think of Iguodala differently this year and realize that it would be an appropriate, you know, representation of what he's done. And the other part is that we could see this year, see some guys put up some stats. This is actually analogous to what Tristan Thompson did last year, where they bounce between starting and backing up. And so that might actually hurt their case. So like, let's say Brandon Knight is playing off the bench for most of the year for Phoenix, but Eric Bledsoe misses some time. He starts like 20 games. Maybe they feel uncomfortable giving him Sixth Man of the Year because he's played so many minutes and because he had a starting role and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see. But I'm fundamentally pessimistic about him winning it just because it didn't happen last year and because he's not great in the box score, the gaudy stats, and there always is going to be a guy who scores a bunch of points off the bench. Like, that's just a thing that happens. And so it could be Brandon Knight, could be somebody else. And so all the other awards, I mean, we'll see. Bob Myers deserves Executive of the Year, even if really the biggest thing that they did was they cleared the space for Durant, which was more set up outside of this calendar year. But that's sometimes the way Executive of the Year works. And so, like, I gave my non-tangible vote to R.C. Buford last year, and that was, a lot of that was created the year before, but that's because they got LaMarcus without giving up much, and the Warriors did that to the nth degree without Durant. So at this point, the only way that Bob Myers wouldn't get it is if the Warriors disappointed, but he still deserves it either way. He's had an absolutely fantastic offseason, and they deserve a lot of credit also for just how well they did with the room mid-level exception and all of the other, you know, minimum guys, David West, buying the pick to get Patrick McCaw, getting, you know, even if I'm not the biggest fan of James Michael McAdoo, getting him back, and JaVale McGee. And so they did a really nice job filling out this roster with immense structural limitations. And we'll see with the new CBA, which of course is not out yet, how that changes their team building moving forward. But you know, you can't care about that for Executive of the Year. So I'm not going to concern myself with that at all. So that is it for this episode. I'll do more in terms of what I'm looking for this season after things start, just depending on how the week works out. Have a couple of potential guests, so it'll depend on who has time and when. But yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. For feedback on this or any other episode, you can reach out to me, Danny LaRue, on Twitter, DannyLeroux, or as the people did in the email bag at the beginning of this, you can reach out, DannyLaRueMBA@gmail.com. Something I haven't asked for before, but if you have a specific preference in terms of like if you want something to be included in a mailbag or not included, and whether you want your name said or not, if you mention it, I will definitely respect your wishes. If you don't mention it, I will infer based on context. So if you have a strong preference on that, please include it, because I want to make sure that you're happy with it. If you want to follow the show, you absolutely could and should. You can go to Locked On Dubs on Twitter, Locked On Warriors on Facebook, which I'm going to try to get better about updating, and LockedOnWarriors@gmail.com, and that's also good for sponsorship opportunities, particularly if you're local, because that is something I can do with Locked On Warriors that I cannot do other places. If you are interested in following my stuff, have had a piece about schedule analysis that came out on The Athletic, that came out, I believe, on Friday. You can check it out. I'm going to do it every month about back-to-backs and kind of structural advantages or disadvantages, so rest advantage and all that kind of stuff. And I went through, so it's not addressing the idea of opponent quality at all. It's more everything else. And because I am a believer in accountability, each month I will also go back through and talk about how those factors, you know, like what happened in those games. So I built a big Excel database of a lot of the information that's in the piece, and then I just now have the avenues for results. So we'll see, you know, like, hey, this game, the other team was on it back-to-back, the Warriors were not, the Warriors won, or however that works out. So it's going to be fun to track that. I've had a back-to-back sheet for myself for years, but I made it a lot more complicated this year, added some more substance, and I'm not the best person at statistically analyzing it, but I can produce the material there, and we can figure it out together, and maybe I can toss it to some people who know things. So that'll be a lot of fun. Also, for those of you who are football fans, the Raiders won this week, the Niners lost. You can listen to Locked On Raiders, Locked On Niners. They do a really good job, and after games is absolutely the best time to do that. So you can listen to Monday's episodes. They will talk about the games that just occurred. And if you're a fan of another place, because there are a lot of people who are transplants that live in the Bay Area, you can definitely check those out as well. And I would definitely, if there's a team or a situation that interests you, give a listen to the Locked On podcast on different NBA teams. I mean, for those of you who listen to Eric Gunderson, he and I did the podcast after Friday's game together. Very talented dude. That's true all over the Locked On network. David does a great job of bringing everybody together and having talent for every team. And so can reach around and see if you find different people who reach you in different ways. And maybe you want to do that as the setup because you want to see what's going on with the team before the Warriors play them or something like that. And so it's fun to be a part of the Locked On network to really see that happen. And tomorrow's episode will be with Jeff Garcia, who does Locked On Spurs. And so we talk about preview of the game and everything like that. So that's kind of along those same lines. And also, for those of you who enjoy my stuff, please listen to Dunked On. We're going to start really in earnest as the season starts, so that's going to be fun, and we're going to do a prediction pod ahead of that, and so I still have a little bit of work to do on that before I go to sleep. So thank you so much for listening to the show. If you want to support it, there are a couple things you can do. You can download every episode, subscribe, leave a rating and a review, and whatever your podcast player. Really do appreciate that. And also, you can check out Athletes Collective. Go to athletescollective.com, see what they have, and if you find things that you like, which I certainly hope and expect that you do, you can use the promo code Warriors and get 15% off. So, thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99. And our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.